Today on Vox Talks Economics, we're playing strategic cops and robbers. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics. So remember, follow us, look us up on Instagram as well at Vox Talks Economics. How do criminals choose the weapons they carry, the number of accomplices, the types of business they target? Economists have long argued that criminals make choices as a strategic decision based on risk and reward. A new analysis of thieves in Milan tests whether this is really the case. Giovanni Mastrobuoni of the University of Turin, Collegio Carlo Alberto, and CPR, of course, is one of the authors of this research. He joins me now. Giovanni, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Tim.
When we talk about crime on an economics podcast, we always start with Gary Becker. When Gary Becker won the Nobel in 1992, I looked up the citation. It was for having extended the domain of microeconomic analysis to a wide range of human behavior and interaction. So is it accurate if I said that he pioneered the study of questions like the one you're asking in this paper?
Yes, absolutely. I should say that not just we start with citing Gary Becker. Almost every crime paper starts by citing his 1968 paper, including our study that we're going to talk about today. So he started it. His work was mostly theoretical. What came later was then an empirical analysis of those models.
And what was Becker's theory about how criminals behave?
It was basically the assumption that criminals are rational beings and they respond to incentives. And so like any other individual, they maximize their expected utility. And in the case of criminals, that depends on the expected criminal proceeds and the costs related to being apprehended and spending eventually time in prison or being sanctioned in other ways.
Specifically, what choices does this mean a criminal is going to make when they're considering crime, and what factors might affect their decision to actually commit crime or not?
We typically distinguish property crimes or economically motivated crimes from violent crimes. I should say that for violent crimes, we don't have a great understanding of where these crimes originate from.
Yeah.
For economically motivated crimes, the idea is that there are individuals that maybe don't have other ways to come up with money. And sometimes they may be forced to commit crimes to make the day's living. And when they do that, they consider potentially the presence of police forces or the potential sanctions they may have when committing a specific crime. And initially, these models were fairly simple. Criminals had to choose whether to work in the legal sector or instead commit a crime. Mm-hmm. And these models became more and more sophisticated. So by now we have models where individuals can do both. And we observe that in the data. There are individuals who commit crimes in the weekend and during the week they work.
Yeah.
And we have models that became more and more sophisticated also. You know, initially they tended to be static. And by now we have more dynamic models where individuals take into account their future utilities from committing a crime. For example, being arrested may eventually make their future labor market prospects look worse because employers may not like hiring someone who has a criminal record. There is more and more evidence that these more dynamic considerations have to be taken into account.
I remember coming across these models for the first time in labor economics, and it took me a couple of weeks to come to terms with them. They are not, generally speaking, how people think about crime and the decision to commit crime. Do the police or other practitioners, do they agree with labor economists on these models?
Yeah, it's funny that you talk about labor economists because I'm a labor economist myself. And when I explain what kind of research I do, I always start by saying, well, I study the economics of crime, but criminals are like any other workers. I mean, they respond to incentives. Like, I don't know, workers respond to wages and employment opportunities, and criminals respond to like criminal proceeds and criminal opportunities. So in my experience, they do, but I might be a bit biased in the sense that I've always interacted with police forces that were willing to share data with us.
Right, of course.
And so probably they were on the good side in terms of views on the potential rational behavior of criminals. Mm-hmm. And they were generally interested in our research. But I'm sure that there might be also in law enforcers who would think this is nonsense. I'm sure about that.
You've mentioned that there has been plenty of research to test out Becker's theories. Well, have we collected good evidence to support the idea that criminals are behaving strategically?
Initially, most of the research was based on aggregate data. One would have data aggregated, say, at the city level or state level. And then on the left-hand side, you would have crime rates. And on the right-hand side, you would have variables that we think should measure those incentives we talked about, like, I don't know, the clearance rate at the state level or GDP, you know, or average income. I think those kind of regressions were indicative, but they were not a smoking gun.
Yeah.
I think one needs more micro-level data to test what the individual criminals are doing. And I think that has been difficult because when I present my work, I always say, you know, criminals don't like to tell what they do.
Yeah.
And they don't like responding to surveys, you know. And so we don't have a lot of data which have information on their expectations about criminal proceeds or what they think the risks of their activities are. But recently, such data has become available. I mean, and the data we use, for example, is part of these new micro-level data sets. In terms of evidence, right now, there are two sets of papers that have either looked at exogenous variation in the expected criminal proceeds. Steve Machen and his co-authors, they have done some great work looking at changes in prices of consumer goods and then match that with data on thefts where they know exactly what was stolen. They find that prices predict what is eventually stolen. You know, like gold prices go up and more gold is stolen. A new iPhone comes out and those are the most stolen items. You know, this is for the benefit side. In terms of the cost side, and a lot of this evidence is actually based on Italian data. So Italy has these policies where they release inmates who have some time in prison left, say 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then if these former inmates are rearrested, then the old sentence is added to the new one.
Right.
And so suddenly you have very similar potential criminals who face very different expected sentences. And research has shown that criminals respond to those expected sentences. So the larger their expected sentence, the less likely it is that they commit crimes. So that's fairly compelling evidence, I would say, that criminals respond to those incentives. There's also a ton of research looking at police presence, but I would say that there the evidence is more mixed and there is a very large endogeneity issue with respect to police, right? So, I mean, fortunately, the police forces tend to be more active in places that have more crimes.
Of course.
And so that's something that makes the analysis of the causal effect of police forces, police activity on criminal behavior more difficult.
We will have a look at the evidence that you have compiled in a second to see whether that supplies what you called a smoking gun.
In June 2024, we spoke to Rocco Machiavello about another aspect of Italy's economic crime problem, the infiltration of organized crime into the management of Italy's firms, and what the crime families gain from these investments in the legal economy. Follow us and listen to the episode, Mafias and Firms.
Your research uses crimes committed in Milan between 2008 to 2010. Why this time? Why Milan?
The time and the city are related to the data that I was given. In 2008, the Milan police forces started collecting data to fight commercial robberies. And the way they do this is they use information about past robberies to try to predict the future location and time of future robberies. So it is a kind of predictive policing, but organized at the individual level. Usually, predictive policing works with aggregate data, where you predict the most likely places of future crime. And here, instead, what they do is they try to predict an individual robbery organized by a group of robbers. Mm-hmm. And so to do that, they need to collect a ton of information about these individual robberies, because they need to be able to link these robberies over time. The way that it works is they call the victims, and then they ask them, how did they look like? How many robbers were involved? What kind of weapons were they using? How were they dressed? Do you have any photographic evidence of them? They ask how much money was stolen, and so on and so forth. And of course, they keep track on whether they were eventually arrested. And so I was given this wealth of information on these robberies. And part of those characteristics are indeed strategies. You can think of like a robber trying to think about whether he should use a weapon or not when entering a pharmacy to steal some money or some drugs. So that's the kind of information that we have.
Yeah, and that gets over that problem, as you mentioned, that criminals don't generally speaking fill in surveys. Does this level of detail distinguish your research from much of that research that you were talking about before?
Yes, it does, because it is uncommon to have such detail. Usually in crime statistics, whenever individual level data are available, at most whether someone was arrested, usually you don't know exactly the amount that was stolen, for example. And clearly the amount that was stolen is very important if one wants to compute some sort of expected haul from a given robbery. Often you don't know who else was involved. I mean, you don't know how many individuals were involved. Usually you have data where one observation is either one criminal or one crime, but you can't really link these different criminals with each other. And then you can't really observe these criminals over time. That's also very unusual. And that's something that we can do in our data.
So in your data, about how many crimes do you have? And what sort of crimes are we talking about here?
So we have a bit more than 2,000 robberies. So these are robberies against businesses like shops, pharmacies, banks, post offices. These tend to be fairly professional criminals. Most of them will be active more than once. And so I would like to have data on the entire country. Unfortunately, only the Milan police force collects these data, which is why we focus on Milan. But the nice thing is that for those 2,000 and slightly more robberies, we have a ton of information.
In the model that you build, what decisions is this utility maximizing robber considering? And can you tell me a little bit about the punishment and how that is affecting their decision?
The way we think of a robber or a group of robbers is that before starting their activity, they need to choose how to organize that robber.
Sure.
Okay, so they need to choose, should we use a weapon or not? And what kind of weapon should we use? You know, for example, should we use a firearm or should we use just a knife or some alleged weapon? They need to decide sort of how many should go, or whether, if it's a single robber, whether he should go on his own. If they decide to go with someone else, they need to choose who should that be. Should he, for example, be Italian, or should he be foreign, or should he mix? Mm-hmm. And then they need to decide he, or I say he because it's probably mostly males.
Yes.
He needs to decide where to strike, you know, what kind of business. Should it be a bank, which is clearly way more difficult to rob, but may bring way more money? Or should they go for like just a gas station, for example? And I can tell you that gas stations are extremely profitable because whenever cash is used, these robbers, they don't even need to get into the shop. I mean, usually there is someone working at the gas station, and so they rob that individual. And so it's very quick. They come and go. Now, some of those strategies will influence both the expected proceeds as well as the likelihood of getting arrested. You can think of that as sort of a subset of those characteristics. The rest may influence not just the criminal proceeds and the likelihood to be arrested, but also the sanctions. And that's because the criminal law in Italy, for example, specifies that if you organize a robbery using a firearm, you risk sentences that are twice as long.
Right.
Or if you work in group, again, it triggers sentence enhancements of about 100%. You will tend to spend a much longer time in prison if you get arrested. So those are the kind of decisions that criminals face. Now, of course, they will also depend on preferences, most likely, and some sort of idiosyncratic factors that we can't measure. But what the model predicts is that if you take those characteristics, those strategies that do not influence the sentence length, then in equilibrium, we should expect that whatever brings more money should also increase the likelihood to be arrested, okay, the risk.
Mm-hmm. In general, does the data that you were working with, does it fit the predictions of your model?
The evidence is mixed. And that could be because some of these things are more salient to criminals than others. So, for example, I can tell you what doesn't fit. What we do observe is that there are certain days of the week that are ideal days where criminals should focus on, like Thursdays. We don't know exactly why. I mean, we think that the police might be more active during the weekends and on Fridays. And so Thursday is sort of a good day for them. If you organize a robbery on Thursday, you tend to bring home more money and face a lower risk of being arrested.
Right.
There are also some locations in Milan that tend to be positive locations for robbers, you know, where they make more money and the risk to be arrested is lower. And these are mostly like locations in the city center where probably more wealth is concentrated. But what we don't observe is that robbers are aware of these locations, because otherwise we would have much larger numbers concentrate in those locations and in those days of the week. On the other hand, we find evidence that is consistent with criminals being aware that if they use a firearm, they risk longer sentences. So we do observe that less than 50% of criminals use a firearm, even though, like in the data, you do observe that individuals who use firearms make way more money and risk much less. Probably because victims are afraid of calling the police if someone is using a firearm. So I would say the evidence is mixed, yeah.
Do you find that all robbers are equally strategic? Are the older ones more strategic than younger ones? Are ones from a certain nationality more strategic? Do we know anything about that?
That's a very good question. In theory, we would be able to do that kind of analysis by simply redoing the analysis for subsets of the data. You know, for example, you could focus on those that look at least older and run the same kind of analysis, or take the subset of foreigners or those that look foreign and do the same thing. But what it means is that you need to slice the data thinner, and we start with 2,000 observations. So we haven't done it yet. But this could potentially be done with richer data, absolutely.
So Giovanni, you mentioned that the people in law enforcement that you work with, they are interested in your results, your work. If something like this was applied in courts for a sentencing regime, could policy like this possibly deter crime?
Our approach, where potential criminals are maximizing their utility, can tell us exactly what the marginal utility of, say, using a weapon. Marginal utility in the sense of both an increase in criminal proceeds as well as a reduction in the risk of getting caught. Now, that increase in the marginal utility of, you know, when using a weapon is what law enforcement and the law should try to undo, in the sense that what the law should do is it should disincentivize the use of a weapon. And in equilibrium, you want to eliminate those gains by increasing the expected sentence. And so that's something that basically our model can do. And it can tell us exactly under some assumptions, okay, because you need to have some assumptions about, for example, the way criminals discount the future. Under those assumptions, and I have some research together with a co-author of mine, David Rivers, where we estimate those discount functions. Under those assumptions, if you're willing to define a discount factor, then we can tell how large those sentence enhancements should be to undo those increases in marginal utility of using a firearm, for example. And it's interesting that the law is not that far off from what we estimate. That doubling of the sentence length is more or less what you need to disincentivize the use of weapons.
What about for the police? Can they make use of the sort of analysis that you do?
Absolutely. The police, they can use the model that takes into account both the expected benefits in terms of money and as well as the expected costs in terms of the likelihood to be caught, to combine these two outcomes and therefore identify locations that are weak spots, locations where criminals might focus on because they represent locations where they are better off operating in those locations. Which is something that without a model, you would not be able to do because you would not know how to weigh the benefits and the costs.
Now, often in this area, what is policy, what's feasible policy, is very far from first best or even second best. If more use of this type of research was employed in forming policy, could it have a real impact on the amount of economic crime that was committed?
I hope so. It's always hard to predict what would happen in the future because you're facing individuals who respond to changes in policy.
Yeah.
Right? So it's a bit sort of the Lucas critique in macro. You make the sanctions tougher, but then robbers maybe move to different types of crime. Or you increase policing in a given location, but criminals move somewhere else. And that somewhere else might maybe is somewhere else that you can't capture in your data.
Becker and Lucas in the same podcast, it's Chicago Day.
That's right.
Giovanni, that's really interesting. Thank you very much for talking to me.
No, thanks for inviting me.
As someone who works in Turin, Giovanni will no doubt be aware of one of the most carefully planned financial crimes of all time, and I am referring, of course, to the plot of the 1969 film The Italian Job, starring Michael Caine. I do assume that you are familiar with The Italian Job, Giovanni.
Yes. I just love Michael Caine.
You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off!
It is, of course, made more or less at the same time as Gary Becker was creating his first research.
That's true.
For a more analytical view on crime, then, we've been talking about discussion paper 20237, Strategic Cops and Robbers, and the authors Giovanni Mastrobuoni and Emily Owens.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next week on Vox Talks Economics, as the Securities and Exchange Commission in the US softens its attitude to crypto investments, who is investing in crypto and why?